I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Florida officials have been trying to get the word out that most of the state's beaches outside of Pensacola on the Gulf Coast are, as a new ad campaign says, still pristine. The ad features a tourist named Dan cavorting on beaches, refusing to leave, stealing seashells from the well-known 80-year-old Florida shell collector Ethel Sinow.
Are those your shells?
Well, I mean, I only picked so many. I left some out there for the kids, you know.
This is the state shell of Florida.
Is that a land dolphin?
I got the state shell! I got the state
Check out great
The
deal.
State of Alabama also has a campaign featuring Lucy Buffett, the owner of Lulu's Restaurant and sister of singer Jimmy Buffett, but Alabama's a harder sell. Daryl Finley manages the Romart House, the historic B&B in Orange Beach, Alabama. It's home to those peach pancakes, Daryl, that your website says are, you know, well, better than sex.
Yes, that's what someone had written several years ago about them, and everybody loves my breakfast. That come here, I have breakfast 7 days a week when I have people here, but
well,
it hadn't been 7 days a week since we've had the oil spill.
Tell us, what's the water looking like today? What is the beach like today?
Well, it's a little, it's tar balls on our beach. We haven't gotten them all cleaned up yet, and I know we're trying. The city is doing their best, and I thank God for our mayor.
Well, we're going to talk to your mayor in just 1 second, but, you know, normally on 4th of July weekend, I'd assume you'd be full. What was your booking this past weekend?
Well, I did about half of what business I did last year.
Yeah. And what did you try to do to get people down?
We've advertised everywhere. And, of course, in June, our business was down 90% compared to last year.
We understand you changed your cancellation policies as well to try to get people to
right,
book.
Yeah. Right. We have, due to the oil spill, if people come here and if they don't want to stay, they don't have to.
We understand you've got a decision to make now because starting this week, business owners like yourself will be able to file for up to 6 months of lost revenue at once. This is from the BP fund that's being managed by Kenneth Feinberg. But the catch is, if you do file for 6 months of lost revenue, you give up the right to sue BP. Which way are you leaning?
Well, we don't want to sue anyone. All we want is, you know, the money that we have lost here due to the revenue, because we're a small business here, and it takes a lot of money to operate this little seven-room bed and breakfast inn. In fact, we had only been open maybe 2 years this September the 24th. We were closed 4 years and 1 week to the day due to Hurricane Ivan and Katrina.
Yeah, and you had to rebuild.
And now we have the oil spill.
Well, you know, let me ask you, sir. You say you don't want to sue anyone, but BP is still working on the relief wells that are supposed to stop the flow. You know, there is still an outside chance that flow may not stop for a long time. Can you afford to take just 6 months in revenue, not knowing what your future really is?
No, we really can't. I mean, I say we don't want to sue. I mean, it might have to come down to that.
So you've got that decision to make. Daryl Finley, he manages the original Romar House, an historic bed and breakfast right on the beach there in Orange Beach, Alabama. Thanks so much, and again, best to you.
Thank you very kindly.
Let's bring in the mayor of Orange Beach, Alabama, Tony Kennan. Mayor Kennan, I'd wish you a happy 4th of July. I know it hasn't been. You've been one of the most vocal critics of BP and the Obama administration's response to the gusher. Last month, you took matters in your own hands. You hired your own engineers, tapped into state money, built your own barrier rather than wait for BP. But you've still got oil coming up. What are you going to do? What does the town need to do now?
Well, you know, we have to realize that there's going to come a time when it's up to us. I don't want us to get into this mode of thinking BP is going to save us. We expect them to do what they said they were going to do, and I'm hoping that the government follows through on what it says it will do. But we also have to understand bad things happen to good people. So we're going to be prepared to pull ourselves out one way or the other when that wellhead is finally shut off and the oil, hopefully we'll see a light at the end of the tunnel. One thing I might want to try to correct here, I met with Kenneth Feinberg last week. I don't think that if you get the 6 months, if you elect to take the 6 months cash up front, you have to sign a waiver. I think they will ask you to sign a waiver if you take a settlement amount that they're going to come back about 90 to 120 days later and offer you.
I see.
then again, that was a very tentative plan.
Because you can't know what your future is going to be. As we said, the relief wells. Well, let's talk a little bit about that, because we understand a machine to wash oil from the sand is on its way to your area. But we also just heard that this huge super tanker that can apparently suck up a lot of oil needs to be tested more. So what is your sense of how you guide your town? Is there a sense of maybe you have to turn to some other industry or something for as many as a couple of years? I mean, what do you start thinking about?
Yeah, that's really tough for us, because just our geographic location and who we are really limits us to a tourist industry. We can't do anything about the wellhead. We have no control over what the government's doing and BP's doing in the skimming operations, the weather. You know, it's just a never-ending hurricane. But in my mind, what we have to do is maintain our integrity, let people know the truth. We never want them to be disappointed when they come down here.
That and peach pancakes. Tony Kennan, Mayor of Orange Beach, Alabama, best of luck to you.
Thank you for having me.
Well, how about a respite from the news? Many chose movies this weekend. The latest installment in the vampire love story, the Twilight Saga, Eclipse, was the top-grossing film, taking in over $160 million. And it made us think, why not take a look at summer blockbusters, starting with the first one. Jaws terrified a generation of moviegoers. It just celebrated its 35th anniversary, prompting us to contemplate the summer blockbuster, and who better to do that with than here and now pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, welcome as always.
Hi, Robin.
And, you know, in putting this together, we realized Jaws was the first.
Certainly wasn't the first film ever released in summer, but was the first summer film to have that kind of cultural impact. It made about $260 million, which in those days was just absolutely unheard of, and it made it in about a 4 or 5 month span.
Yeah, and by the way, we know that since then there have been, you know, dozens of films that have raked in more. You know, Avatar is number one on the list right now. But, you know, we're talking back then. This was a big deal that everybody would go see this one movie. Do you remember seeing it?
I do. I was 12 years old, and my parents took me to see it. It was absolutely terrifying. I wasn't a big beach person before that. In the 35 years since Jaws came out, I think I've been in the water twice.
Well, see, here's the deal. Again, Jaws coming out in 1975, directed by Steven Spielberg. You've only been in the water twice since it came out. I've never gone to see it because I go in the water all the time. I've never seen it.
But it says everything about the impact of that film that you've never seen it.
Never seen it.
But you know much about that movie.
That's why I won't go see it.
No, that's when you have a cultural touchstone. When you haven't even seen the film and you know almost everything there is to know about it.
That's right. I might as well have seen it. Let's move on. And by the way, if you've got a summer blockbuster favorite, go ahead and send it to us. You can go to hereandnow.org. We've got a button there for you. Just click it on. And we know we're not going to touch on them all because there are so many. But 3 years after Jaws, who can forget this?
Summer loving had me a blast.
Summer loving happened so fast.
I met a girl crazy for me.
Met a boy cute as can be.
Summer days.
Olivia Newton-John, John Travolta, Grease.
You know, at that time, highest grossing musical ever. It was based on a long-running Broadway show, and, you know, musicals had been pretty dead at that point. You know, you certainly weren't getting the big Hollywood musicals like you had been in decades earlier, and people loved it. John Travolta, who was really at the peak of his popularity at that time, you know, could really do no wrong, and it reflected that. Everybody was singing songs from it and dressing like these people, and it was a big deal.
Well, let's move to a subset of the summer blockbuster phenomenon, which is the summer sequel. You got to start with Star Wars, The Empire Strikes Back.
We have a new enemy, Luke Skywalker.
Yes, my master.
He could destroy us.
He's just a boy.
These days we're used to, you know, Iron Man 2 and, you know, continuations of the various big movies. But in those days, you know, 30 years ago, you didn't have a lot of that. You didn't, you know, when Star Wars came out, you didn't immediately assume there'd be a sequel, and then there would be a sequel to the sequel.
Well, explain that a little more. You know, today, we're so used to this. There's so much promotion. when a movie comes out, we feel we've already seen it and judged it before we see it. Going back to Star Wars, you didn't know anything about that.
You came into Star Wars not knowing a lot about this movie. You heard about it, Star Wars, you didn't know what it meant, and you went to see it, and you were taken on this sort of wonderful adventure. Maybe the advertisement looked interesting, maybe you liked the poster, and you went in. I remember seeing Star Wars as a kid. I don't think I knew anything about that movie. You know, I certainly didn't know who Harrison Ford was. I didn't know who Mark Hamill was. And, you know, by the end of that summer, you know, they suddenly became the biggest stars on the planet.
Well, take care of yourself, Han. I guess that's what you're best at, isn't it?
Hey, Luke. May the Force be with you.
30 years ago with Star Wars and even with Empire Strikes Back, even though it certainly had anticipation for Empire Strikes Back, you went in with a kind of purity. You went in very sort of clean and pure and didn't know what the movie was about. And I think it made it an easier way to enjoy the film.
Well, and it created a number of stars, including, as you said, Harrison Ford, who then became the star of another summer blockbuster, Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981, another Steven Spielberg biggie.
Just a big rip-roaring, almost like, you know, Saturday morning kind of serial. And it spawned sequel after sequel after sequel, and Harrison Ford might be too old to keep doing them, but he is, and people keep seeing them. But it all began with Raiders of the Lost Ark in 1981.
There's a big snake in the plane, Jock! Oh, that's just my pet snake, Reggie! I hate snakes, Jock! I hate them! Come on, show a little backbone, will ya?
Well, and Renee Grammer reminded, you can't really talk about summer blockbusters without pointing out that so many of them came from Steven Spielberg.
For a good long time there, Steven Spielberg was really the king of the summer blockbusters. It was essentially, you know, if it's summer, it's got to be Spielberg. From Jaws to Raiders of the Lost Ark to, of course, in 1982, E.T., you know, no one was putting out better summer films than Steven Spielberg.
Now here's a scene. Henry Thomas starred as the boy Elliot. And this film introduced Drew Barrymore as his younger sister, Gertie.
E.T. Home phone.
E.T. Phone home. E.T. Phone home. E.T. Phone home. He wants to call somebody.
Oh, my goodness. Still, you get a lump. And the silhouette of the bike going up into the air.
Yeah, a beautiful film. It worked for kids. It worked for adults. I mean, that's what really great summer blockbusters do. They aren't really targeted for one audience. They bring in everybody.
We're taking a break from the news with pop critic Renee Graham. We're talking summer blockbusters. By the way, listener Nigel Ack, I think I've pronounced that correctly, remembers Ghostbusters. For Elizabeth Seelog, it was Grease. To add your favorites to the list, just visit our Facebook or go to hereandnow.org and look for that shark from Jaws and leave your comments there. Later, we'll go back to the news, but more summer blockbusters in a minute here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking summer blockbusters with Here and Now pop culture critic Renee Graham. And Renee, I want to go back to the July 4th weekend, 1996. The film that ruled the box office was Independence Day, the Earth invaded by very unfriendly aliens, Will Smith starring as a pilot who's not afraid to use violence when an alien attacks him.
Welcome to Earth. That's what I call a close encounter.
And Renee Graham, we hear you're not a big fan of Independence Day.
I'm not a big fan of Independence Day. Mm. You know, this is where you start to see a bit of a sea change in the way that summer blockbusters are being made. They're big, they're noisy, there's a lot of crash, bang, boom, you know, a few dumb lines here and there, but it's all about the spectacle. You had a film like Independence Day, which is really interesting to watch now because, you know, back then, people thought it was really sort of cool and funny to watch iconic American buildings being blown to bits. People don't really see that anymore. And I think it says a lot about that movie and the way that it hasn't really aged all that well, that the movie wasn't really that good, even though it made a lot of money and it really, you know, did a lot for Will Smith's career. But no, I'm not a fan of that movie.
Well, let's move on to another film, big in the 90s, And surprise, directed again by Steven Spielberg, sort of the guy who helped invent the summer blockbuster. And this one had a lot of big dinosaurs, Jurassic Park.
It's essentially Jaws with dinosaurs, if you think about it.
Jurassic Park stars Sam Neill, Laura Dern, Jeff Goldblum, and a lot of other people who basically pretty much scream throughout the whole thing.
Well, that's the difference. I think if you ask most people about Jurassic Park, they're going to say dinosaurs. They're not even going to remember who starred in the film. Because I think by that point, you know, Spielberg is also doing the same thing. He wants to create this sort of incredible thing to watch. But what the people do in the movie is really irrelevant. It's all about the dinosaurs.
Well, but Renee, you say summer blockbusters became all about formulaic sort of smashing and crashing and bashing. And yet, we have Up.
Last year's Up. This was a film that had a lot of sort of buzz going into it. It had gotten good early reviews, but people weren't really sure how it would do because you had this, you know, summer films are usually geared to an audience that skews young, and no one was really sure if a film with a senior citizen as the protagonist would succeed.
And not only that, it opens, there's not a lot of dialogue, sort of illustrating that this elderly couple, when that man was younger, they can't have a baby. Very sad.
And by the time the dialogue starts, he's a widower.
Yeah.
So
she dies.
You're not quite sure where this is going. You have this almost 11-minute sequence that's, you know, deals, which sort of has this sort of decrescendo in a way where the couple meets and it's wonderful, but they can't have children, and then she dies, and then the film really gets started, and you have this sort of crotchety old man voiced by Ed Asner, who ends up going on this sort of amazing adventure and traveling to Paradise Falls, this place he always said he would travel to with his beloved late wife, Ellie.
And also, might I add, and I think you weigh in on this as well, the best depiction of dogs.
The best depiction of dogs, and the sort of the lead dog in the film talks exactly the way my own dog speaks. So it was really nice the way they captured that. Just the ways that dogs get distracted by things and the ways their minds work. Squirrel. It's so perfect in the way that it shows dogs. I love the movie for that.
Let's listen.
Please be my prisoner.
Doug, stop bothering Kevin.
That man there says I can take you, Bert. And I love that man there like he is my master.
I am not your master.
I am warning you.
People completely got that film. They gravitated to it. It did incredibly well. It won 2 Academy Awards. I think grossed about $300 million and really surprised a lot of people.
Well, and what about this year? We mentioned to start the Twilight Saga Eclipse. Bafo at the box office, but are there blockbusters along the scale of an E.T. or a Jaws or a Raiders of the Lost Ark?
You know, nothing I'm seeing that's going to have that kind of lasting power. You know, obviously, you know, a movie like Eclipse, it's made a zillion dollars this past weekend. You know, it's going to be what it's going to be, but I don't know that in 35 years people are going to be talking about those movies the way that people can look back on Jaws or the way they look back at E.T.
Well, and while we have you, Renee, we just felt we wanted to mention a film, not necessarily blockbuster, but big, and just celebrating its 30th anniversary on July 2nd. Your thoughts on Airplane?
Airplane. I can't believe it's been 30 years. This is one of the great comedies of all time, and not just because it's funny, but because of the influence it's had on the Farrelly brothers, this sort of constant, hilarious, bawdy comedy. I think people, again, nobody knew what to expect when that movie came out, and you had all these really serious character actors like Robert Stack, Leslie Nielsen, Peter Graves, playing these hilarious characters, but doing it completely straight. And of course, at least to me, the great scene of that movie is this sort of genius stunt casting of Barbara Billingsley as a woman who can speak jive.
Would you tell him to just relax, and I'll be back as soon as I can with some medicine.
Just hang loose, blood. She gonna catch up on the rebound on the med side.
What it is, big mama. My mama raised no dummies. I duck her rap.
Cut me some slack, Jack.
It's probably lost on younger generations, but to see, you know, June Cleaver, the mother of all 1950s sitcom moms, saying, you know, cut me some slack, Jack, and you know, he ain't got no brains anyhow. And she does it better than I could possibly do it. Was just mind-blowing and hilarious. Just an incredible comedy that really holds up. And it's one of those films that just keeps throwing things at you. You're going to laugh at something. There's not a down moment in that entire movie.
And Renee, you know, it's also a film that we've said in the office, we reference every single day because we do a lot of crosstalk, a lot of quick firing of questions. And there's always someone who says something like the line from Airplane where the woman has to go to the hospital and someone says, hospital, what is it? Well, it's a building where they take sick people, but that's besides the point. Every day we say something like that. And that's a sign of a good movie.
And it's funny every single time you say it. And that's the thing. There was something so sophisticated but also simplistic about Airplane that really worked and resonated with a lot of people. And even though it wasn't the biggest film then when it first came out, I think, again, its influence is just immeasurable.
Well, on this holiday, we thought we'd just take a look at summer blockbusters with Here and Now's pop culture critic Renee Graham. Renee, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
And, of course, thanks to Jerry and David Zucker and Jim Abrahams for giving us Airplane. Okay, back to the latest news, then a job search makeover, all next Here and Now. Thailand is still dealing with the fallout from those deadly anti-government demonstrations earlier this year. More than 80 people were killed when the Thai army cracked down on the so-called red shirt protesters. They'd occupied the capital city of Bangkok for 2 months in April and May. Now the Thai government is pushing what it calls a roadmap to reconciliation to try to heal the rifts caused by the protests. But at the same time, hundreds of arrests have been made, and the Thai government is vowing to prosecute the Red Shirt's leaders on charges of terrorism. The BBC's Rachel Harvey looks at the aftermath of Thailand's worst political crisis in decades.
This is one attempt to ease Thailand's pain. Superstars from the pantheon of pop appearing together for the sake of national unity. May our happiness return, the chorus goes. Bring back the love. Bring back the old, peaceful Thailand. In the video, being played on TV and on Bangkok's elevated train network, the singers are superimposed over images from the final, violent days of the recent anti-government protests. The project was the brainchild of one of Thailand's best-known movie directors, Prachyapinkao.
I saw how all those familiar places had changed, the burned-down buildings and deserted streets. So I thought, I want to have the singers standing right there.
The images are quite dark. You see Bangkok on fire, you see deserted roads, but you don't see any protesters. Why is that?
I didn't want to take sides. I believe that all Thais, whatever their politics, we all feel sad about the losses. If I added visuals of red shirt protesters, I think it might create more misunderstandings.
I've come to a street market right in the heart of Bangkok. This used to be where the anti-government protesters had their camp. When that protest was brought to an end by the military, some of the demonstrators went on the rampage and burned down the buildings around here. So what's happened now is that a lot of the traders who were inside the buildings have taken their businesses out onto the streets. The Den Supakit family used to own a shop specialising in silk evening dresses. Now they're reduced to selling T-shirts from a market stall. T-shirts emblazoned with positive messages. I love, or more accurately, I heart Thailand, and together we can. The problem these days, Wong Suwon tells me, is that Thai people don't love each other anymore. So I designed these T-shirts to try to create a new trend and help people forget their differences. They're selling well, he adds. He's not the only one to have the idea. All over Bangkok, people are sporting similar items. Walls and shops are festooned with posters professing love for the city. But is this about forgetting differences or just burying the past? Around the corner from the T-shirt sellers, I met Jirawara, who works in public relations. I asked if she believed that sentimental songs and slogans could really help overcome Thailand's bitter divisions.
I do believe it would work. I think right now it's better to see something good. And I think for Thais, we all believe that everything going to be fine. It's very Buddhism. When something happens, what we have to do is just move on. it's like the lesson learned and remind us not to make a mistake again.
Whether or not any lessons have been learned from the recent protests is very much open to question. The underlying grievances which persuaded people onto the streets in the first place remain unresolved. The government is now promoting a plan for national reconciliation, but it admits the process won't be easy. A musical anthem with a message of peace and love might perhaps at least help set the right tone.
The BBC's Southeast Asia correspondent Rachel Harvey reporting from Bangkok. This reminder, you can always listen to our show stream live at hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast. And don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter at Here and Now. Up next, a college grad's job search makeover, Here and Now. Well, you've heard it before. Recent college grads looking for a job are having a hard time of it. The Monster College networking site recently surveyed 1,200 recent grads and 200 employers and found that nearly half the employers said they expect to choose from 51 applicants for every job. And only 32% of grads think they'll make more than $36,000 a year straight out of school. So with loans to pay much more than that, many of them have moved back in with their parents already. But there are jobs, so how to get them? Kimberly Delgizzo is the Director of Career Services here at Boston University, where we're located. Kim, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us, one of the recent grads she's working with, Daniel Esro, who won the BU Job Search Makeover, including a brand new suit. Dan, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
We note you're not wearing the suit.
That is right. It's a little too hot out today, I think, for that.
And by the way, it was a contest by a tweet, and your winning tweet was, "A jobless at BU haiku. 2.5 majors, 4 awesome years at BU, not one job in sight."
That's right.
That is a haiku there. Now, what are the two majors?
I studied political science and mass communication with a focus on advertising.
We understand, Dan, you are working 35 hours a week right now designing brochures and other communications at the BU Marketing and Communications Office. So, Kimberly, he really is kind of ahead of other students, I would think, isn't he?
Absolutely, he is. He's been engaged in a variety of activities throughout his BU experience that has helped him to develop skills that will position himself very well.
But still, Dan, so you win this makeover.
Yep.
It included not just the suit, but counseling. What did you learn that you didn't know?
The biggest thing was just the importance of the small things in networking. You know, sending the thank you note as quickly as you can. The handshake was something that we talked about. My handshake was apparently a little more firm than it should have been.
Oh, yeah, it is. I should tell you that.
Still working on it.
That's my reformed version, so you're lucky that you didn't get the original before Kimberly's intervention.
So you're literally, you know, not squeezing as hard as you once did.
Yeah.
And what else?
Just really the importance of networking, not only the importance of it, but how to do it, you know, what to say in the first email when you're asking for an informational interview, what to do if they don't email you back.
Well, let's stop right there, because that's what you're talking about, asking for informational interviews. There may not be a job, but asking people if you could just come in and have informational interviews.
Right. Any job that's posted, they've been completely inundated with resumes, and it's barely worth it to even send one to add to the top of the pile. I mean, it's much more important to focus on networking and just meeting people so that when a job finally does pop up, you're kind of top of mind for
them.
They
might think of you.
Yeah.
And Kimberly, we understand from those informational interviews, you drop off a resume, and that might head to an office, again, ahead of a job being open.
Yes, but also to ask the person they're networking with for some feedback and recommendations as to how the person who's working with them might tweak their resume. How might they tailor it most effectively?
And Kimberly, let's talk for a second about job interviews, when you finally do get to a job interview, because there are standard questions that employers ask, and you can go in prepared. You can know your answers in advance, or even maybe present the answer if the question doesn't get asked. What are those questions?
One of the questions that I think is key, whether or not someone receives this as a question, having prepared for it ahead of time will help them to market themselves successfully, and that is what we call the blockbuster question, which is, tell me about yourself. Oftentimes, candidates don't know where to begin with that question, and they might start talking about what their academic background was. Not that that's a bad thing to discuss, but I think the most critical thing is to demonstrate that they've done their homework, so they know about this position they're interviewing for, and they want to build a bridge for the person who's interviewing them.
To help the person walk to them.
Exactly. Yeah. So to really articulate for the person they're meeting with how they fit that particular position.
Give me a concrete example of this, Dan. You're meeting with me for the job. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you.
There you are with your major in political science and advertising. And let's say our job is, communications for our public radio station here, you know.
Sure.
So tell me about yourself, Dan.
Sure. I think ever since I was little, to me, the idea of being able to have control, telling your own story in a way that it resonates with people and people understand it and can relate to is really important. And it's important on a personal level, but also on an organizational level too. And I think it's really interesting to take an organization that is really complex and has all these different touch points, whether you know it's on the radio, it's online, it's in person, and taking all of these things and all of these relationships and distilling it down to a really simple idea.
Oh, you're hired. You're so hired. Well, see, he didn't even hesitate. Is that what you're looking for, that confidence?
That's exactly what we're looking for, yes.
And you say that's what employers want. But, you know, what if they don't? What if they really did want to know, no, Dan, I really want to know, do you like sports? How do you figure that out?
Absolutely appropriate to finish the response to the question and then say, is that helpful? Can I give you additional information?
Yeah. And you say that there's one question that's a trip up. It's when people ask, what's your weakness? Dan, what's your weakness?
You know, I would say one thing that I struggle with, and specifically in terms of my creative process, is that, you know, you're at the beginning of the process and you're thinking of all these really great ideas, but it's really important to let them go and focus on the good ones. But I have a tough time. I want to nurture them a little bit longer than I should sometimes. But, you know, you work with your creative director and figure out which ones are the good ideas. But I am kind of a good mother to all of my ideas and don't want to let them go quite yet.
See, he's been really, he's drunk the Kool-Aid here. Because,
he
I was surprised you didn't say, you know, I just work too darn hard. And I have to, at a certain point, can you lay it on too thick?
Absolutely.
You're nodding yes, Dan. You can. What about just presentation? I know that even just jiggling up with a pen or jiggling your knee.
I think it's definitely something you have to think about, and you have to, you know, maybe devote 10% of your energy at any given time to be thinking and making sure that you are presenting yourself well. Personally, for me, the challenge is that in the ad world, a lot of people are wearing jeans and t-shirts every day, so I have to walk the line of not coming in and being overdressed and seeming too buttoned up.
Yeah.
So when I went in last week on an informational interview, I wore kind of a casual suit and a dress shirt unbuttoned with no tie, and I was still overdressed compared to everyone else there, but it wasn't to the point where it was uncomfortable.
Right.
That speaks to knowing the culture you're going into. Whatever the industry is, Robin, it's important for people to know what culture they're approaching so that they can present themselves in a way that really does fit for that environment.
Boy, we learned a lot. That's Kimberly Delgizzo. She's Director of Career Services at Boston University. And Daniel Esro, he won BU's Job Makeover Contest and is still looking for a job?
That's right, yep.
Boy, you just did a really big interview with a lot of people on the other end of the radio. He wants to be in advertising?
Yeah, an art director.
An art director. Dan, lots of luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. And announcing, again, an astounding and audacious academic accomplishment, an author's abnormal alliterative addiction. Okay, I quit. I can't do any more. I was trying to introduce this next piece the way our next guest would, with words that begin with the letter A. You might remember Robert Manson Myers, a retired English professor whose 200-page book, Ars Amatoria, contains only words that start with A. Ars Amatoria, Latin for the art of love, is a collection of poems, but it also includes an introduction, a biography of the author, even a glossary written entirely in words that start with A. We spoke last May with Professor Myers, whose name appears in the book as author anonymous, and asked him why write this book?
That is, of course, a very reasonable question, and everyone asks it. I luxuriate in strict forms. My dinner parties are always sexually symmetrical. Ooh. No man sits by a man. No woman sits by a woman. I like restriction. And, of course, needless to say, confining myself to 6.25% of the words in the dictionary, that is a confinement.
Yeah.
It's the only letter, I think, that you could achieve this with. A is the only one that gives you any sort of smooth flexibility, as it indeed does. The two lacks, and they are painful lacks. We do not have the definite article, the. Right. We do not have the preposition of, O-F.
Well, I understand that the original Ars Amatoria, The Art of Love, by Ovid, is quite scandalous. Is your book as scintillating?
There are some rather saucy, naughty dits in my book. I am not young, I'm not modern, and so I might be more shocked than my readers. I think you are going to be equal to this shock.
Okay, let's
I will
hear.
Read you a couple of couplets. These okay. are couplets. Arlene's alluring apparatus arouses Algernon's afflatus.
Whoa! Is it going to be scandalous if I ask an afflatus?
I couldn't imagine Robin Young being scandalous. Yes, ask away. And that's A's. I find myself talking in A's all the time.
Well, what's an afflatus? I'm almost afraid to ask you.
Oh, dear, afflatus. An enthusiasm, zest.
Oh, shoot.
An urgent okay. feeling.
Okay.
Algernon's afflatus has been aroused.
Okay.
By the, and, of course, apparatus is an outrageous word for you know what.
Yes.
And that is the source of the humor. There's a great deal of humor here. I have to stand on my head constantly because I can't say it in any other way but with A's.
We understand that you started keeping notes when you were 14 years old.
That's
that,
right.
That you would, if you heard a sequence of three or more words beginning in A in a row, you'd write them down.
Yes.
And by the way, we should say you've won the National Book Award in 1972 for The Children of Pride. That was
That's
a,
right.
a collection
that
of letters.
That is the 2,000-page Civil War.
Wow.
Epic. Yes.
Book, letters yes. from a prominent Georgia family. So you yeah. you know what you're doing here. How much
yes.
How much fun is it?
A great deal.
Yeah.
This is a tour de force, this book. It's a jest. It's a stunt. It was a lot of fun, but let me tell you, it was a lot of work.
Oh, I bet. I bet.
What you read in 2 minutes has taken, might take me 3 weeks. Rewrite. 10 different versions. You
yeah.
read it in 10 seconds. Yes.
Well, I'm looking at Adele. It's a rather long poem, but just the first stanza. Adele, an ambidextrous alligator, an absolute abrupt abbreviator, an artful acrobatic amputator, admired as Acme's arch asphyxiator, apprised as Acme's armed assassinator, an ardent arabesque annihilator. Adele.
I am thrilled. You are the first, Robin Young, to give me the pleasure of hearing my lines read. It is a very special experience, you know, to have someone else read your own lines. I must inform the hearers, of the ending of that poem. That's the longest poem in the book. Poor Adele has quite a difficult time. She doesn't like her friend Eileen, and she eats Eileen.
Eileen, the anxious agitator.
Yes, she's a dreadful person, and so Adele eats her. And then, of course, Adele has to pay the price. And the last line, alas, another alligator ate her.
It's just, how long did that one take you?
Oh, it started as a four-line poem. Then it grew. Some of them took me a year. I mean, I would work on them and then lay them aside and come back. When I started, I had, of course, all these notes I had been saving since prep school days and was preparing to write a whole book of prose. In the morning I started, April 2006, I walked upstairs to my desk and I said, I wonder if it's possible to write a poem. And so I ended up with 190 poems, which makes a book. And so a second book may follow, depending on how eager my readers are, and that will be prose. Huh. And I am now well along on my next book. It's a novel, and I am thrilled to be back to 26 letters of the alphabet. It's a delight.
That's Robert Manson Myers, a retired English professor and avowed Anglomaniac. As he just said, he's got a book coming out that uses all 26 letters of the alphabet. He might write another book in prose using just words that begin with A. And do I understand, Professor, you are 88 years old?
I'm 88, and I plan to live at least another 100 years because I have so many things on my plate. Thank goodness my mind seems to be working, though I suppose my readers are the best judges of that.
Well, Professor, thank you so much, and we just bid you adieu. Anchors away. Amen.
Adieu.
Absolutely amazing. That's the author of Ars Amatoria, also known as Robert Manson Myers. We spoke with him last year when his book first came out. Well, as we go today, some news from the weekend you might have missed. General David Petraeus accepted his new command in Afghanistan, saying the Taliban are killing civilians, even using children to carry out attacks. In answer, we must demonstrate that Afghan and international forces are here to safeguard the people and that we are in this to win. But Michael Steele, chair of the Republican National Committee, told supporters at a fundraiser winning may be impossible. Steele also moved the goalposts on when the war in Afghanistan began. He said it was a war of Obama's choosing, not something the U.S. had actively prosecuted or wanted to engage in. If Obama is such a student of history, Michael Steele went on, had he not understood, you know, that the one thing you don't do is engage in a land war in Afghanistan. Well, Republicans like Liz Cheney and William Kristol are calling for Steele to resign. The war in Afghanistan was, of course, launched 9 years ago by Republican President George W. Bush. Well, meanwhile, most Americans were busy celebrating this weekend, and we were honored to be smack in the middle of the annual Martha's Vineyard 4th of July parade with campers and counselors from Camp Jabberwocky for the Disabled. This year, their theme was outer space. Picture wheelchairs converted into rockets, Luke Skywalker's at the wheels. As one onlooker said, they're about overcoming odds, about doing what you're told you can't do. What's more American than that? We'll have a full story for you down the road, but today, a taste of what made people in Edgartown, Massachusetts smile this weekend. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Please join us to see what the week brings here and now.